Back together again, you and I joining for a midweek Wednesday edition on February 16th, 2022 of Connecticut Today. I open the show wondering out loud again why career criminals, many with mental health issues, are allowed back on the streets over and over again. Sacred Heart University Government Professor Dr. Gary Rose joined us for his monthly check-in to talk about the latest state and national political news. And courtesy of the folks at the Connecticut Network at ct-n.com, we are comments from State House Republican leader Vin Candelora on a possible controversy in the Lamont administration. 4:30, we're going to have some audio, a clip, a chunk that was aired earlier today by CTN, some of the Republican lawmakers at the Capitol laying out their legislative priorities. But State House leader Vin Candelora, who's on this program a lot, he was asked about, well, a couple of burgeoning, can I use the word scandals? Now, you know what was happening with Mr. Colangelo, the former top prosecutor in the state who has resigned because of a little allegations of a quid pro quo, I should say, with Costas Diamantis from the OPM office, and stuff rolling back into the realm of Paul Mounds and Josh Jabal. And now we have allegations that nothing proven, but there are allegations that the governor, or maybe at least somebody in his office, may have known about some funky stuff going on with contracting in the state. So we'll get to all that a little bit later. But I had to start with this, and I had a couple, three things I was thinking of starting with. And then our news folks there at the top of the hour actually use this. And I use this. It's a New York City story. But I use this, A, because so many thousands of people listening to me right now have a connection to New York City. A lot of Lower Fairfield County folks at least were commuting and probably will commute again into and out of New York once everybody reopens in the city. We all have friends and relatives who live there. And it's one of these things that's just I don't know. It's maddening. I don't know whether you heard about this case. And the reason I cite this case is because I have wondered, and maybe you can help me with this, because I honestly don't understand what's going on here. I have wondered, especially in big cities. Now, apparently the problem here in Connecticut, thankfully, thank God, we do some things right here. And thankfully, the problem with homelessness in Connecticut isn't as bad as it is in major cities, including people who are on the street and by all looks are insane. They're nuts. They're crazy. I hate to use those words, but we know what they mean. But my fascination is why, especially in a lot of Democrat-run blue cities, why is the homeless population, the homeless problem so bad? And yet nothing is done. And I know there are people that have outreach services, and that's fine. But fine, outreach to them when they're off the streets. Shouldn't public safety be number one? And why is it in so many of these big cities around the country, people that are just, I'm sorry to use this word, these words, folks, but I don't care at this point. They're nuts. They're crazy. They shouldn't be out on the street. And yet, some public officials who are charged with keeping keeping cities safe, with keeping cities habitable, or however you want to say it, on the streets, where people don't have to worry about getting hit over the head or thrown onto subway tracks or stabbed. They continue to let these nutcases live on the street. How about this case? And again, this is what was cited by our folks at the top of the hour here. Christine Yuna Lee, 35-year-old woman living in Chinatown in New York City. She worked as a creative director for a music platform called Splice. Early Sunday morning, around 4:30 a.m., Lee was returning home to her apartment when 25-year-old Asimad Nash began following her. He caught the front door of her apartment building before it closed and followed her inside and all the way up to the sixth floor. When she opened her apartment, he pushed his way in. He grabbed one of her kitchen knives. One of Lee's neighbors was awoken by the screen. By the time cops got there, it was too late. She was dead. The delay was apparently the result of responding officers unable to get through her steel front door. They tried to break it down, including with a sledgehammer. Anyway, they finally got in there. It was too late. She was dead. Now, this guy, this nut, this fruitcake, this guy that should have been in a rubber balloon somewhere, Asimad Nash, has been arrested multiple times in the past month, including twice for assault. He has, read along here, folks, he has three open cases in Manhattan dating to last year and 27 counts of criminal mischief. Two busts last year for possession of stolen property and assault. In the assault case, Nash is accused of slugging a strap hanger in the right eye at the Grand Street station on September 28th while the victim was swiping a Metro card. Naturally, Nash was released without bail after the assault. He was later arrested on a warrant but was released again. And according to the New York Post, he was also arrested last May and charged with assaulting a woman, but that case was sealed for reasons that aren't clear. A member of the Chinese Consolidated Benevolent Association saying Lee's only mistake was to move from Jersey City to New York City, something she had done relatively recently. Maybe Nash, it says here, is schizophrenic, or maybe he's a drug addict, but the bottom line is, why is he on the street? What I don't quite understand the pension, the propensity of in a lot of big blue-run, Democrat-run cities for keeping sickos on the street. Well, we don't want to have cash bail because, you know, Paul, that's discriminatory. It is? Well, now you have a woman who's dead. And I'm sorry, I'm going to talk about this stuff. This is crazy. This is nuts. In what kind of a functioning society do we let nutcases, and I'm sorry to say that, but that's what he is. You shouldn't say that, Paul. He has mental challenges. Yeah, and it's also known as being crazy, and now a woman's dead. And the guy wasn't held on bail when he should have been, and again, there's a woman dead. It is mind-numbing why, as a society, we allow this sort of stuff. Why do we, A, not keep people who are clearly mentally incapacitated, who are clearly threats to society, why do we not leave those people locked up for years until we can straighten them out, if we can? I don't understand it. I every day I read these stories, and I try to bring them to you, A, because you need to be careful out there. Suspect everyone, especially in a big city. I'm sorry to have to say that. But the propensity now of no cash bail and to keep letting repeat offenders repeat over and over and over again, and here in Connecticut, we seem to have, well, one party more than the other making excuse for juveniles who've been arrested 2, 3, 4, 5 times, so much so that our local police departments are saying, yeah, we know this kid. Yeah, he's with us all the time in here. And why are we allowing that? Why are we allowing that? Can you answer that for me? 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. Once again, 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. I do not understand it. Why do we keep making excuses for criminality here? Again, I will say it again because I feel I have to, because somebody's going to call up and say, hey, you just want everybody in jail. No, I don't. No, I don't. But it is mind-numbing how a relatively intelligent country allows people who are out of their minds, who are threats to themselves, to others, and society, why we let them walk amongst us. What in the hell is wrong with us? Monthly check-in with Dr. Gary Rose. He's professor in and chair of the Department of Government at Sacred Heart University. Gary, hi, it's Paul again. How are you, sir?
Hi, Paul. How you doing? Good afternoon.
I'm good, Gary. Thanks for joining us for our monthly check-in. Appreciate it. Boy, Gary, I got to say, if I'm Joe Biden, I got to be wondering, saying, well, okay, I have COVID, I have inflation, and now I have to deal with Russia. I mean, I don't think this is anything that he anticipated when he was running a year and a half ago. My God.
No, he certainly didn't. And right around the corner could potentially be Taiwan as well. So, no, there are myriad problems that are facing the Biden presidency that I'm sure he did not anticipate. And the question is he capable of stepping up to the plate to deal with them? And many Americans, as public opinion polls show, do not feel confident in this presidency right now.
I thought, Gary, though, the speech he made, the address, the 10 or 11 minute address he made yesterday, I thought it was good. It was specific, and he was very stern. And I think he laid out what would happen. And it was interesting, Gary, toward the end of that, I don't know whether you picked this up, he did kind of tell people, if worse came to worse, to brace for high gas prices. But I thought he was pretty stern yesterday.
Yeah, he was pretty competent, I thought, and he seemed to be a little more direct and lucid, actually, compared to some previous presentations. And you know, I think what he is doing at this point is he is trying to demonstrate that he is not just a crisis leader, but he's also a leader who is calm and can be deliberative. And you're right, I thought it was a pretty good delivery. And then we have the forthcoming next month, State of the Union address, and his poll numbers are terrible. They are, but it's possible that we're starting to see possibly an attempt to reverse that trend.
Yeah, and Gary, also on the national scene, I saw the other day, speaking of poll numbers, and you and I both know they see internal polling that the regular folk like you and I never see. It is now, Gary, 30 incumbent Democrats in the House not running for re-election. Now, I'm sorry, Gary. I know a lot of people love their families, and they all say, I want to take my grandchildren to the park. Well, okay, Congressman, but there's more going on here, isn't there?
Oh, very much so. And, you know, midterm elections, which are right around the corner in November, they are almost always a referendum on the sitting president. That's really what, for all intents and purposes, a midterm election is. And right now, you're correct. A number of incumbent Democrats are feeling that they're going to go down in flames as a result of being associated with the president who the nation largely, for all intents and purposes, doesn't feel very confident in. And so they're bailing now. And, you know, but, you know, many of these individuals who leave Congress, they're going to give up their congressional salary, but they'll be right back through the revolving door as lobbyists with incomes that are triple what they're making right now. So, but you're right. I'm a little hesitant about saying we're going to be watching a red wave, but I'm starting to lean in that direction more and more.
Dr. Gary Rose is the guest. Gary, hang on. We'll be right back with you. First, traffic and weather together right here on WICC. 600 AM, 107.3 FM and online at WICC600.com. Our monthly check-in, Dr. Gary Rose, professor and chair in the Department of Government at Sacred Heart University in Fairfield. Gary, the governor, Ned Lamont, gliding along during COVID, getting some pretty good marks. Now we're winding down with that. And all of a sudden, Gary, there seems to be this little air of controversy, maybe short of scandal, but, you know, some funny business with Colangelo and Mr. Diamantis from the OPM office, and some allegations now swirling and being made by Melissa McCaw. And then, Gary, we hear over the past couple of days that there's more controversy about this, the contracting process now bubbling up here in the state. So I'm sure this must be causing the governor and his campaign a little bit of agita right now.
Yeah, and after the state of the state address, Bob Stefanowski showed up outside the House chamber and was interviewed. And the first thing he pointed to, which obviously is going to be a talking point in the Republican campaign, is that the Lamont administration is under a federal, you know, grand jury investigation, and which they are. And, you know, I've been reading all about what's going on with Diamantis and his daughter, of course, working for Colangelo, and then Colangelo trying to get, you know, pay raises from her father, you know, and then these construction projects. I'm trying to connect all the dots, and I'm having a little difficulty to see how to make the connections. But there's got to be some type of, you know, connection that's going on here with this. And I know that the daughter apparently did work for a construction company and have some expertise in that area as well. So there's something that's going on here that. It's as if you have like two issues, but I'm wondering if the two in any way are directly related to one another. And that's something I'm trying to figure out.
And you wonder, Gary, and then you're right, because is the overlap here, you know how you have those graphics with two circles and they overlap and people say, well, this is what you have to look at. You know, you wonder if, Gary, I don't know what hit you, but I'm saying, well, does this have anything to do with, allegedly, with some of these allegations Melissa McCaw is making? Like, did anybody tell her, hey, just keep your eyes forward, don't do anything? I mean, if she's upset, no telling what she could say.
No, it's, I know, and in this age of like the Me Too movement or what have you, and all of that that's going on. So you add that to this other mix of issues, and again, like I said, it's like I don't know if now there's a third dimension to it or if somehow it's all related. But that's really what grand juries, I guess, have to decide. Stan Twardy has already done a lot of work on this, and I think eventually more is going to come to light. But you know, getting back to the larger picture of scandal or scandals in the plural, this is obviously something that must be troubling the governor. And I mean, Colangelo, of course, was going to be fired, but he resigned, and the daughter is now on administrative leave. And, you know, this is going to, it seems to me, Paul, that this is only going to get bigger and bigger as we go along, and we're going to learn more and more about what's going on. And then who knows, you know, what happened with Colangelo and Diamantis and all of that and her hiring, whether or not that's related to what's going on with the pier in New London and then all these local school contracts. That's why I'm saying, and then you got the McCaw issue. I'm just trying to connect the dots to everything, but I think eventually we're going to be able to. I think, you know, from unless these are just totally separate incidents,
And you know how this works in politics, Gary. No matter what happens, anybody, including Bob Stefanowski and any opposition candidate on either side, right? They're going to say, well, the guy, the boss here, you know, the buck stops with the boss. You know, he can he or she can say, well, I had no idea. Well, you're supposed to have an idea, right?
Well, oh, absolutely. Sure. He's the chief executive. He presides over the executive structure. And, you know, we're talking about individuals that are extremely close to him, both Diamantis and Colangelo, you know. And so there's absolutely no way around this that, you know, Lamont could possibly say that he was unaware of what was going on, because these are almost direct subordinates. And so we're not talking about, you know, some civil servant tucked way down in a bureau somewhere. Mm. We're talking about high-level administrators. And so, sure, you know, the buck does stop with him, and he has to know what's going on. And sooner or later, they're going to have to start getting some responses from him about this. And so far, there doesn't seem to be any real adequate discussion on his part, but there should be. It really should be.
Yeah, and finally, Gary, you know, there's a little buzz now because the aforementioned Mr. Stefanowski happened to show up at the 5th inaugural celebration for New Britain Mayor Erin Stewart the other night. And, you know, she did participate in the lieutenant governor's race 4 years ago, but dropped out. Now she's been reelected twice. You already have a female lieutenant governor for the Democrats, so you wonder, Gary, here's a moderate Republican woman who's now been elected five times in a blue city. You wonder if Stefanowski and the mayor of New Britain there, Aaron Stewart, could be a ticket.
Teaming up, it would be an extremely strong ticket, in my opinion. It would be balanced in so many ways, insider, outsider, male, female. He's from Madison, and she represents a pretty urban area, it's not really a huge city, but nevertheless, she's got great experience in governing at the local level. And so I think that really you could put together a very strong ticket to challenge, Lamont Bisowitz. And I see that as, I'm always hesitant. I've had dream tickets before, and then you find out some things. But nevertheless, to me, that if I was a Republican consultant, I would say, you definitely need to consider Aaron Stewart as a running mate this time around.
But the thing, Gary, that may stand in the way of that is this, again, I have to explain to people who don't understand it from out of state, this kind of shotgun marriage system that we have here is that our governor, lieutenant governor candidates, they don't run as a ticket. And, there are people, Gary, who would say that, as much as I've known him over the years, a guy like Joe Markley, who was, he's a hard right individual. Joe's a very knowledgeable guy, but he probably cost Bob Stefanowski some votes last time.
Yeah, he did. I mean, some say he helped shore up the conservative base, but at the same time, I don't think Stefanowski needed him to do that because Bob had already moved to the right, to win that primary, and he outflanked some of the conservatives himself. And so I don't think he needed Joe Markley really in that last campaign. But you're right. It's a strange system that we have where, you have two separate nominating processes going on, and then you have to weld together a ticket that you may or not like, and that a gubernatorial candidate might look and say, gee, I don't want this person as my running mate. But yet, he or she is with the person just by virtue of the Connecticut law and the way that the nominating process works. I have been thinking that it's time to possibly review how we pick running mates here in Connecticut, and maybe some reform is in order, Paul. I do think there, should it be along the lines of the presidential model, where the nominee of the party, perhaps selects a running mate who then has to be confirmed by the convention, as opposed to having two separate, a gubernatorial and then a primary, and then a primary for lieutenant governor. It's kind of archaic, I think.
Yeah, but it gives gives us something to talk about, Gary,
that's true.
Dr. Gary Rose, professor and chair, Department of Government, Sacred Heart University. Gary, as always, thanks. We'll talk next month. Thank you.
Okay. All right, Paul.
Appreciate it. Thank you. Always good thoughts there from Dr. Gary Rose at Sacred Heart University.
So I think in the immediate future that the legislature certainly could put together its own committee of inquiry to look into this. I think every school construction project in the past and going forward needs to be looked at and reviewed. Certainly we have these other legislative ideas to bring more transparency to the process, but I think it would behoove us to attempt to restore faith in government by beginning this investigation into the process, how it happened, how we got here. Certainly we know there's a criminal investigation that will be ongoing, but I think we need a legislative one as well.
You mentioned that moving school construction from DAS to OPM violated state law. What law did...
So I believe there was a statute that put the school construction into the Department of Administrative Services. And so when that position was moved into OPM, it was in direct contradiction to that statute, and also it was budgeted that way. And so it was a unilateral decision made by the governor, signed off by the governor, that allowed that to happen. And so it not only did it happen under his watch, he was overseeing it throughout the entire process. And I think it was something that we were always critical of. And unfortunately, I think subsequently, Democrats did codify it and allow it to occur. But prior to that, it was done in violation of the budget and the statute.
What questions do you have for OPM Secretary McCall?
Well, I mean, I think generally we need to peel back all of these contracts, you know, whether it is school construction, test kits, the SEMA 4 contract. There's a lot of questions that have been raised. Certainly what is going on in the Port Authority in New London. I think this all has to do with these no-bid processes, the accusations of quid pro quo, and I think that our OPM secretary is certainly part of that, and she would have to answer those questions as well. You know, at a time when this building is completely shuttered, and I feel as if the minority party right now is the only voice pushing back on these issues, I think it's more important to begin an investigation. If Democrats want to continue to operate the way we are without transparency, then they need to put better processes in place to prevent the bad things that are going to happen because of the lack of transparency. Well, I mean, she is a governor appointee, and so it's not my decision. I think it's the governor's decision. I certainly have concerns overall what I have seen out of this this administration. And so for the governor to suggest that, you know, he would fire somebody conveniently who he was unable to fire is to me is a disingenuous way of dealing with the situation. You know, I don't care how you would have handled the state's attorney. I'm more concerned how you're going to handle the people in your own administration. And thus far, I'm not seeing a lot of proactivity coming out of this administration, especially when we know there was a memo dating back to July of 2020 that pointed out all of these problems. And to suggest that he can't recall whether or not he read that memo is pretty appalling.
Why are the auditors of public accounts not adequate? I mean, when the New London thing happened, you know, there were those hearings and there was that additional investigation by that.
So I certainly think that the auditors of public accounts provide a very important resource to us. But there's a few things the way they go about. You know, they're planted in these agencies. A lot of the information that they get is through cooperation and interaction with those agencies. And they are sort of doing audits, not necessarily forensic audits. And they're independent from a legislative perspective. But I think that the investigations that need to occur may need to involve subpoena powers, and I think need some openness and transparency. The auditors work much slower. They issue their annual reports. They're typically ignored by the legislature. We've asked for public hearings on those reports, and they fall by the wayside. I'm concerned that the governor's suggestion is sort of a half-hearted attempt to create the appearance that they're going to conduct an investigation, that we all know setting it up that way through a budget process will take months and months and months, well beyond the November elections. We believe the investigation needs to occur today, not waiting for the legislature to pass legislation to do it.
So who would do the investigation? It's not clear to me. Independent people would come out? You'd hire somebody?
Dealing with this immediate issue, I think that similar to the impasse where we saw the GAE committee come together to investigate emails that were sent around by a Republican governor. We saw this entire building come to a screeching halt and an investigation being conducted over those emails. We have accusations of millions of dollars flying out the door with no-bid contracts. I would hope my Democrat colleagues would show the same interest in that money flying out the door as they did with a Republican governor, and they could model it the same way they did 10 years ago.
Can I ask an off topic? So the governor just had somewhat of a victory lap over at a nursing home in Bloomfield when the extension of the executive order gives visitors to nursing homes the ability to go in without being vaccinated or without being tested as of March 15th. I mean, are we there yet with our most vulnerable population?
Well, I mean, I think I struggle with anything that the governor is doing on any of this. I mean, we talked about our most vulnerable, and on the one hand, you know, we're allowing individuals into nursing homes to visit, and we have continued to shut down schools. And the Office of Early Childhood has now come out with an edict that five-year-olds and under still need to be masked because they're not vaccinated. So at the same time, we're masking a three-year-old, which if anyone's witnessed what that looks like, if you think you're protecting anybody from a virus by throwing a thing that mask on a three-year-old, you're out of your mind. That I just question what we are doing with the nursing homes. It's two complete departures.